Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. American Impressionist painter Mary Cassatt's art is re-examined in this lecture recorded on May 14, 2014 at the National Gallery of Art. Professor Hollis Clayson argues for a new approach to understanding Cassatt's signature mother and child paintings and her early black and white intaglio prints set in her Paris apartment library. The monstrosities in question arose from often overlooked aspects of the artist's radically inventive art. This program was held in conjunction with the Degas-Cassatt exhibition on view at the National Gallery of Art, the sole venue, from May 11th to October 5th, 2014.
This afternoon, I want to discuss with you two clusters of artworks by Mary Cassatt and ponder them through two completely different lenses, even though consideration of both groups will land us in and around the year 1880. Number one, I aim to discuss some of her signature images of adult women and children from the perspective of her national class and gender identity. That group is exemplified by this astonishing painting that lives in Wichita, Kansas. It's the best work of art in the entire central section of the country. I'm sure that's no one will find that to be a controversial assessment. Part two will find me talking about a group of her early black and white intaglio prints in order to argue for the close connection between two developments that helped to define modern Paris: new urban lighting and innovative printmaking, an opportunity for me to demonstrate an especially close link between technological modernity and pictorial modernism. So I'm going to start by honing in on Cassatt's so-called mothers and children. It'll give me a chance. To piggyback on the wonderful current exhibition by asking even more questions about Mary Cassatt's reputation, and it will let us think hard about what we might call and regularly do the European tradition in American art, inasmuch as Cassatt expatriated, as you all probably know, from the United States to France. Now, this is where I have to say something a little bit cranky. It doesn't seem right to be cranky under these glorious, indeed pampered circumstances. But this projector is not very good, okay? I was kidding before, but I do believe it was produced during the Harry Truman administration. And as a consequence, some of these fabulous things by Mary Cassatt are not shown to great advantage. And that said, I'm just going to carry on. Anyway, until people experience Kim Jones' exhibition, they may merely think of Cassatt as the mother and child artist par excellence. And assigning her this label was well underway during her own lifetime. The first book written exclusively about her art was penned by a French critic named Achille Segard. It was 1913, and he titled the book, pointedly, Mary Cassatt, un peintre des enfants et des mères, painter of children and mothers. One of my goals is to get her out of that Procrustean bed by pointing out how aesthetically wild those pictures are, vexed and tense too, yes, full of radical monstrosities. As you can tell, maybe some of you were roaming around for gifts before Mother's Day, that whoever is in charge of signage and advertising in the gift shop had the same thing in mind. You'll see here that Mary Cassatt's whole achievement was collapsed down into a great thing to distribute to your mother on Mother's Day. I hope after my lecture you might think twice about that. So let's just have this as the placeholder while I talk a little bit about this, the issue of the European tradition in American art. Here you can see the plaque that was placed on the building that she lived in for all the way from 1887 to 1926. It's interesting vis-a-vis the relationship that's being probed in the exhibition that first, hallelujah, she's an American impressionist painter, but then she's a friend and colleague of Degas as the sort of second keystone of her identity. So Malcolm Bradbury, who wrote decisively about the European connection in American literature, underscored the extent of the attachment by observing, quote, A good proportion of American works of fiction, poetry, aesthetics, and history have been written in Europe, end quote. Remember, my friends, that Huckleberry Finn, that quintessentially American novel, was written in Italy. As Bradbury explained, post-colonial America's reinvention of a mythic Europe demonstrated that, quote, perhaps America, more than any other nation, needed Europe as an idea, end quote. All across the 19th century, up to the eve of the First World War, the need for Europe apparently remained pronounced, yet was a source of nonstop tension, contestation, and anxiety in the U.S., especially around the practice of expatriation for cultural reasons. It was part of the struggle, distinctively American one, I think, between national particularity and cosmopolitanism. The desire to become cosmopolitan, right, by shedding nationality was and is not the exclusive aspiration of United States artists in the years under discussion. It was pronounced, but yes, it did belong and still belongs to a broader syndrome that we might call, following Bradbury's clever locution, the progressive disaffiliation of artists from the nationalistic model. After the Civil War, the tension around Americans choosing Europe sharpened as Europe became identified, this is again Bradbury speaking, not only with cultural and traditional values absent in the U.S., but also with the American past that was being lost, end quote. Hence, Europe was often dehistoricized, its modernities overlooked for ideological reasons. But around 1900, conceptions changed, and two understandings of Europe went into circulation. Old Europe, never mind other politicians who have used that expression in intervening years. I'm pleased to say I can't remember, was it Cheney or Rumsfeld? Never mind. Old Europe was the realm of culture and tradition, while New Europe was the sphere of modernity and modernism. The voluntary exile, the social actor of great interest to me, is instructive insofar as she demonstrates the tensions about location and nationality, obligation, and independence that mark modern art. Now, indubitably, how's that? That's whenever anybody uses the adverb indubitably, I don't know, you should always check your phone pull the alarm. Anyway, I'm using it today. Indubitably, these issues and tensions strongly inform the career and artwork of Mary Cassatt. I'm showing you now, that's actually the building in which she bought that apartment in 1887. Born in Allegheny City, Pennsylvania, present-day Pittsburgh in 1844, she began traveling to Europe in 1865 and settled permanently in Paris in 1874. In 1887, she moved into an apartment in this building at 10 Rue de Marignan in a very fashionable part of town in the 8th arrondissement, not far from the rond-point of the Champs-Élysées, and she never moved again. Combined with the Paris apartment, her purchase in February 1894 of this pretty substantial pile out in the countryside, a country property, the first house she ever owned, secured the stability of her city-country dwelling pattern for the rest of her life. My only regret is the absolutely amazing photographs of me running around this property could not be found in time for this lecture. Once she owned the Chateau de Beaufresne out in Ménil-Terribus in the Oise region, 50 miles northwest of Paris, the prior cycle of peripatetic summer rentals was broken. So here's the key number. She lived a total of 52 years in France. Determined, as many of you know, from an early age to be a professional artist, once settled in Europe, she at first followed the standard artist's path by submitting her figure paintings to the Salon, a yearly exhibition of work by contemporary artists juried by the Beaux-Arts administration of the French government. When, in 1877, her colleague, Edgar Degas, asked her to exhibit her work with the independent group, which had the very sort of scientific name, Société Anonyme des Artistes, Peintres, Sculpteurs, Graveurs, etc., as you know, Dugan Cassatt preferred the title independent, but everyone ended up capitulating to using the derisory term impressionist in a sort of self-mocking way eventually. Anyway, when she received that invitation, she eagerly agreed and exhibited work in four of their eight shows. The first in 79, in which this fabulous piece was shown. You can actually see what this looks like by going into the galleries. Anyway, she was in 79, 80, 81, and 86. Now, because of her welcome as a foreigner by the Impressionists, she was the only American invited and embraced. Certain assumptions have dogged our thinking about her art and the conditions in which she made it. Seeing her as fully integrated into the artistic avant-garde in Paris, scholars have regularly deemed Cassatt a de facto Belle Époque Parisian. In much art historical writing on Cassatt, her at least intermittently thwarted transnational cultural identity is a non-issue, or rather conceived as simply an objective and thus easily described condition. Most art historians just reckon she captured what I would call the expatriate's golden fleece, namely unproblematic, fully stable cosmopolitanism by possessing all the characteristics fully suited to multiple countries. And for me, the big question is, oh, did she? Cassatt's signature so-called mother and child pictures are very instructive for thinking about artwork as the cultural precipitate of transatlantic experience. And in Cassatt's case, let me use this phrase I like so very much one more time, partially thwarted cosmopolitanism. While the present discussion acknowledges the ambition and formal proficiency of her pictures, it underscores their awkward aspects, understood here as indices of her dilemma. Oh, I thought just because I criticized the projector, it was going to stop listening to me. You know how, yes. Anyway, thank you for your understanding. Okay. So, though you already saw the label on this when I started out, it's the picture that's in the Los Angeles County Museum. So, though the so-called mother-child motif only became genuinely prominent in her work in about 88, 89, she initiated her trademark series in 1880 with this picture, which has had a lot of different titles. La Toilette de l'Enfant, or The Child's Bath, at first, and now it's labeled in Los Angeles, Mother About to Wash Her Sleepy Child. Right. It was Cassatt's first close-up, entirely figural depiction of a physically adjacent child and female caregiver in a domestic interior. Though not exhibited until 1895 and not in France, where it was painted, but in a monographic show at the Durand Ruel Gallery in New York, it has enjoyed a very long run in art history as an emblem of the painter's modernity and of her innovation as an eventual specialist on the theme of closely knit women and children at home, configured or at least widely interpreted as mothers with their children. The 1880 Los Angeles picture. The 1880 Los Angeles picture is shot through with tension and conflict of a sort to be found in quite a few of Cassatt's trademark so-called mother and child paintings. But when I first started thinking about this, and I studiously worked my way through the extensive art historical literature on paintings like these, I couldn't find in it any echo of the surprise and perplexity I experienced before the pictures, insofar as almost every Cassatt scholar or casual observer has tended to make a case for the pictures' manifold realisms, many by arguing that they depict the psychic and social truth of later 19th century mothering practices or of motherhood itself. I've been unpersuaded by the assertion that the meaning and value of the pictures reside in their thematization of maternal love and pleasure. I became convinced instead that the women, the mother figures, were incidental to the pictures, serving as mere circumstantial conveniences, instrumental in the literal sense of offering the abiding assurance of innocence. In a word, an alibi. accentuating the realism of the maternal scenes fashioned in the paintings, indeed even insisting that they are mothering events, obscures our ability to see their patent strangeness and manifold contradictions. A realist approach can also threaten to foreclose an investigation of the critical conditions of and motivations for their making, the artists, modernism, decorum, and expatriation. So I'm going to talk about this in some detail. I'm just setting it up with maybe one more paragraph. So the argument here is that Cassatt was drawn to the subject of women and children because it was only the template and milieu of ostensible maternity that gave Cassatt access to the unclad body, that of the child. It was, in fact, I think, an overdetermined choice for an exceptionally ambitious modernist figure painter who was also an upper middle class woman, a lady, and an American expatriate. The multifaceted oddity and eccentricity of this picture should, I hope, problematize the claim, the commonplace claim, that Cassatt's art represents the truth of childcare or of children. As a modernist figure painter, the canvas exemplifies Cassatt's ongoing effort, once ensconced in Paris in 1874, to reconcile her reflexes and solid competences as a volumetric figure painter with a competing agenda. The impressionist aesthetic ethos of loose facture, flatness, and oblique composition, and its epistemology of this the disinterested glimpse of the urban modern, the aesthetic shrewdness of the young Mary Cassatt can hardly be overvalued, insofar as she declared that her idols among her artist contemporaries were the greatest innovative figure painters of the age, Courbet, Manet, and, oh yes, Degas. Now, this is going to show you that I've been hanging around at Casbah. That the structure of Cassatt's trailblazing picture echoes a Madonna and Christ Child by Antonio da Correggio, the Madonna of the Basket, I hope will come as no surprise. Cassatt, while not having benefited from a fellowship at Casbah, was nonetheless well-schooled in Correggio's art. She saw plenty of his artworks in Parma in 1872. Indeed, she was hired to copy his work commercially. And she may have seen this very painting in London during an 1871 visit. Its small size would not have prevented it, I believe, from serving as a specific compositional model for Cassatt's later and larger canvas, and it offered a precise thematic analog and inspiration. In the Correggio, the Holy Mother is getting her squirming son dressed in a homemade woolen jacket. Here they are together. In order to construct an adequately broad adult bodily platform for the sprawling child in her own canvas, Cassatt, like Correggio, implausibly, even grotesquely, elongated the woman's left thigh and finessed altogether the point of connection between that upper leg and the woman's hip, a stratagem concealed and enabled by the body of the lolling child. Note how the word baby does not quite fit this reposing giant, poised unstably between lying back and sitting up. Not only is the adult's upper leg deformed, but the convexities of the two caregivers' knees also demarcate an awkward, because not sharply enough angled, orthogonal back into space, which disobeys the laws of illusionistic foreshortening, right? Her left knee should be even farther up and smaller relative to the right. This structure further confuses the volumes and space of the woman's enormous lap, as though the weight exerted by the oversized child, especially that left leg, has actually dislocated her body. Correggio's half-naked baby Christ is a featherweight by comparison. The caregiver of the impossibly capacious lap also uses, take a look at this, an extraordinarily, even abnormally long-fingered left hand to secure the massive child. I've used the word giant to characterize the child, and what a titan he or she is. Its body reaches all the way from the woman's chest down to her shin, while the fleshiness of its face and its legs suggest a child who's still not walking and perhaps just under or around a year old. The child is extremely massive and tall for a baby. In fact, if Cassatt's painted child could be imagined upright, don't be afraid, it would be almost half the mother figure's height, an impossible stature for one still so young. There's also, is there not, the vexed question of the faces in that picture. The foreshortening of the woman's head yields a minimal and oblique profil perdu, as we like to say it in art history, because French words sound so suave, which is eyeless and mask-like. Her pose and the cock of her head assure a bodily and even psychic reciprocity with the child, but no legible facial expression delivers on the promise of her somatic disposition, and she appears as a consequence robotic or even merely subservient, and to my eye, beleaguered, frozen by, and almost exaggeratedly subordinate to her gigantic, expressive, and somewhat threatening charge. But what adult look could solicit and bolster that child's inspecting glance? Its pointed expression is striking, even unsettling on two counts. The sustained, heavy-lidded gaze into the face of the caregiver strikes a note of subtly disruptive maturity, already instated by the partially supine pose and yielding arm gesture, and further bears the disquieting trace of a smirk. A look, in other words, that seems to have been imported from and to emulate an inquiring naked child's gaze within a completely different contemporaneous sphere and genre of French painting. That of a subsidiary male figure in the eroticized scenario of a salon nude. Do I really mean this? Just be patient. The look on the face of Cassatt's child put me in mind of the famously, inappropriately, erotically inspecting Puto. Here's one. Flying aloft the body of the recumbent Venus in a French salon nude like this one, Alexandre Cabanel's Birth of Venus from 1865. Let's get a close-up. I'm not proposing that this is the particular source. There are lots of pictures around like this. Here's another one, Ancres, Venus, Anadiomen. Just take a look at this fellow down here. Anyway, let's just go back to this exceptional face for the moment. So the link I'm proposing here between Cassatt's sleepy child, we should really, you've taken that in. There, let's put those two together. So the link I'm proposing between Cassatt's sleepy child, situated within the safety and familiarity of a space of childcare and a household interior, and an erotically interested Puto in a mythological setting, is central to my broader argument about the nature of Cassatt's interest in the topos of the domestic woman and child. She wanted to paint the unclad human body, as did any ambitious figure painter at the time. The adult male nude was out of the question for her, and she had attempted the adult female body. There are a couple of her goes at it in the print medium, in the exhibition, in the galleries. But as you'll see, verified by them, she only did so in an inchoate and evasive fashion in those several prints. So my claim is that in her first and other paintings to follow of the inquisitive, increasingly undressed child, her model was, of all things, the rapt and admiring Putti of Birth of Venus paintings, the extraordinarily sexualized scenario in which the sublime Venus emerged full-grown from the foamy wreckage of the castration by the titans of Uranus, the first ruler of the world. Her model was the Venus and a Puto, triangulated, cleansed, and updated via the model of a Madonna and child, channeled through the vehicle of the domesticated mother and child. Let's return for a moment to the plaque on the building. So after the scattering of the Impressionist group in 1887, her involvement with Les Peintres Graveurs, the painter printmakers group, became especially important to her. She was, however, maybe you don't know this, wait till you hear this. She was, however, thrown out. That sounds too strong. She was cast out of the group in 1891 when its name was changed to Peintre Graveur Français, French painter printmakers. The demon of the piece was Félix Braquemond, thus excluding foreigners like her from the enterprise. In 1894, nonetheless, she wrote this to her friend Sarah Tyson Halliwell, quote, "After all, give me France. Women do not have to fight for recognition here if they do serious work," end quote. The artist's own emphatic espousal of professional France beyond the moment of rupture in her relations with Parisian artist colleagues and the upsurge in xenophobia in France that subtended the break suggests that her custody of cosmopolitanism was contingent, right? Even contested, and thus required occasional strong assertion, you might say reassertion. Her claim to cultural transnationality certainly encountered the obstacle of ascendant anti-Americanism in France, and thus had a vacillating credibility, which affected her artwork and sense of well-being as an expatriated U.S. citizen, or at least that's my sense of things. In this regard, the testimony found in a curious popular book, The Great Good Place, American Expatriate Women in Paris, by William Weiser, is plenty intriguing. It reports a 1914 luncheon between the 29-year-old Philadelphia-born artist George Biddle and an aging Mary Cassatt out at the country home. I'm quoting from this funny book. During lunch, it had become apparent to George Biddle that Mary Cassatt, for all her years, most of her adult life spent in France, had developed an aversion to the French. His own wary attitude toward the Parisians he had met, the awkwardness of getting on with the Gallic temperament, corresponded only in part to her situation and sentiments, but her distaste had developed over a longer span and ran deeper. She must, in the beginning, have been charmed by all that was French, don't smile, as he had been, and especially charmed by the city of Paris at first sight. Something in the American character was at odds with the French temperament, and yet the original enchantment persisted, becoming a permanent resident but never a concitoyen was the common fate of long-term expatriates here. Nevertheless, expatriates seemed oddly comfortable and perversely resigned to the ambivalence France aroused in them. The question of the link between Cassatt's frequently strange depictions of women and children and her hybrid and contested cultural nationality is a key interest to me, a key issue for me, and I believe she was navigating some of the treacherous waters evoked by young Biddle as early as 1880. Let me make just a quick couple of comments on this utterly fabulous painting that lives in Wichita. We have here another massive child controlling the caregiver with her volume and her powerful, if alienated, hand gesture. We see here the adult's body melts away beneath or is simply replaced by a formidable explosion of paint strokes at left. The tower of hands, look at this. The tower of hands and baby limbs at right is an extraordinary pileup of severed limbs that speaks much more loudly to the logic of painterly invention than to a description of caring womanly hands on a child's leg and torso. Note, too, the child's disappearing leg and the caregiver's erased, ovoid head. It's tempting, I wouldn't dare do this, to just turn it upside down and say, come on, that's primarily a wild and radical painting. It's only secondarily tethered to a domestic narrative. I only talked about two pictures, which is sort of disgraceful, but anyway, I just wanted to put a couple more up on the screen, including this gorgeous one from the National Gallery, in order to indicate there are many other modes that one can address with these issues in mind. In the case of the pastel at the left, you literally have a child trying to get out of the picture by reaching out to the right. What's going on in the National Gallery thing, you can take that up another day. But just a quick recap of my argument before I move on to the next matter. So my argument is, right, that the determining conditions of her artistic practice, encompassing her engagement with artistic modernism, her sex, social station, and her striving for a genuine transnationality led her inevitably to the body of the child, necessarily accompanied by an adult woman caregiver, a mother or surrogate mother. In the modern child, I'm tempted to say only in the subject could she articulate and further her artistic modernism and social modernity while preserving her distinction as a decorous, if worldly, American lady. The bumpiness and unevenness of her quest for cosmopolitanism helps to account for some, I think, of the complexities and occasional tensions in her artworks centered upon adult women and children in the spaces of domesticity. Now, one more thing about the singularity of Mary Cassatt's whole journey and the choices she made. I'm back thinking about Malcolm Bradbury's propositions. The conceptions of Europe that drove Cassatt's decision to expatriate were highly unusual for an American artist of her generation, insofar as the model of Europe, eventually France, that sustained Cassatt's expatriation was uncommon among her immediate contemporaries. At the start of her European travels, right, she was drawn to the traditional cultural Europe, what we've already called old Europe, the consummate source, right, of social distinction and reaffirmation for well-to-do Americans, so familiar from the novels of Henry James and Edith Wharton. But from 1877, and that's why this picture of super modern, brightly lit, clogged up with leisure seekers Paris is on the screen. From 1877, that moment when she accepted Degas' invitation, she was also galvanized by the Europe of modernism and experiment, New Europe. That the latter valence of Europe, which exerted its magnetic force on most other expatriating American artists only following World War I, attracted Cassatt as early as the 1870s, made the ideological and personal motivations for her relocation to Paris, I think, especially striking and indeed highly unusual. The example of Cassatt points to the manifold ways in which the complexities of the transatlantic experience inevitably marked and shaped the artistic output of every artist who was a voluntary exile. On to part two. So let's turn now to a discussion of the startlingly novel intaglio prints that she made between 1879 and 1882, set in the library of her own apartment, the one she was renting before she bought the big rig in the 8th, the one she was renting in the 9th, also not an unpleasant part of town, the 9th arrondissement. The prominence of a glowing lamp. This is the preparatory drawing, as you can see, for this very etching. The prominence of a glowing lamp in this and almost a dozen other etchings is my specific point of interest. For example, this soft ground and aquatint accords the spherical globe of the solitary visible light source such tonal and design importance that the artist hands over some of the work of fashioning the image and its tonal harmonies to the givens of shape and luminosity of a household lamp, to the degree that a print like this one could be called almost something like an allegory of the madeness of illusion. Also striking, right, is the fact that the blank and luminous disc would be the only non-worked portion of the print were it exclusively an etching. But because it's also an aquatint, the shining circle is, on the contrary, the zone accorded the most attention, knowingly blocked out before the resin-covered plate plunged into the acid. Equivalently startling is the undeniable similarity between the unhatched orb and a luminous full moon. Though Cassatt's moon globes stint on illuminating their environment, they glow, but without appearing to shed much light. I want to give you, if only in a sort of rough and ready way, some kind of acquaintance with the other sort of works in this small corpus that interest me, the other lamp-centric intaglio prints, a couple more of them here, to hurtle quickly to the point. I want to suggest that her round white lamp globes echo, guess what? The new lights in the street. I'm showing you here their treatment by probably the greatest caricaturist of the age. Who can resist this? So here are your average passerby of an evening going past the newly installed lamps in front of the opera house. Blindness in the Place de l'Opéra, electric illumination established by a society of unemployed oculists. Oculists were some of the great villains of the later 19th century. All this unbearably bright, eye-piercing glow was imagined to be some conspiracy so that people who worked, you know, on prescribing glasses and the like could make more money. Okay, the connection that I'm going to be sort of working through between the circular glaring arc lights newly installed in the city and that unhatched globe in Mary Cassatt's prints, that connection mirrors in turn, or at least fits in well with, one of the fundamental conditions of modern urban life. And here one always needs to quote Jonathan Crary, quote, "One crucial dimension of capitalist modernity is a constant remaking of the conditions of sensory experience. The new street illuminations in Paris bathed the city relatively quietly, though blindingly." Those new lights were harsh and glaring Yablokov candles, the most popular kind of electric arc light of the moment. Gas, which was still blazing all over town, by contrast, was noisy, comparatively orange-yellow in hue, softer, and had a wavering flame. In discourse, the eye-piercing new lights were figures for the contrary coexistence in modernity of freedom, efficiency, and comfort, but also mechanization, control, and unease. Back to this linked pair. The huge spherically globed table lamp is really effectively a third being at that table, a full-fledged constituent of an intimate gathering. It's a towering sentinel, let's call it a beacon for a parlor. Its featureless frontal face-like disc stands watch over the two adjoining human zones. It sutures the two spaces. But its strong mechanical identity and object stateliness work to separate one busy woman from the other. In spite of their shared morphology, the three orbs, two women's head, one lamp globe, the three orbs do not coalesce into a network of cognate spheres. Degas often has that happen in his exactly contemporaneous prints. But despite being a machine, the lamp's humanoid qualities do push its presence and membership in a trio gingerly into the camp of the uncanny, while the small, round-headed creature nonetheless retains, don't you think, the alterity of an alien. In both the drawn and etched versions, Cassatt certainly fussed over, good heavens, the form and placement of the lamp, the rim of the globe exactly skims the upper sheet and plate, right, exactly, and forces the void of the lamp globe into contact with the margin, with the end of the image. And she went out of her way to establish sharply demarcated contours for the lamp, emphatically parallel marks outline the leaf-enhanced cylindrical body, and so on, and repeated contours delineate the crisp spherical shape of the globe. The women appear comfortable in their intimate coexistence and yet are nonetheless distant from one another thanks to the intimidating lamp, which is just too psychologically and environmentally daunting to function apotropaically. That's not what I want. That's what I want. There. The quiet, nonverbal sociability at home instanced by the print is clearly enabled by the lamp's light. Indeed, reading to oneself, silent reading, was a very modern practice. A resultant parallel is surprising but trenchant. There is, on the one hand, the modernity of the two figures' quiet coexistence, and on the other hand, the blazing contemporaneity of Cassatt's rendering of a lamp globe that glows like the moon but fails to shed light on its surroundings. Like the problematic arc lamps out in the street, Cassatt's lamp dazzles and does not illuminate. It is a lighthouse for a parlor. Now, here comes the exciting part, the product of my increasing number of years as a card-carrying lamp nerd. What power source could have fueled such an intense glow? Or rather, what kind of indoor light lamp served as the objective referent of Cassatt's investigation of the quality of illumination in the increasingly technologized city of light? Well, it's very important to understand what kind of lamp she had, and I'm going to tell you in a minute. In her art, it functioned beyond itself in order to signpost light outside in the street. In other words, her investigation of a domestic interior lighting scenario that she knew intimately was a metaphorical displacement of the newsmaking light environment of the Parisian outdoors. I hope that claim is shored up by what comes next. The actual lamp featured here was neither a gas nor an arc lamp. Some art historians have called it an arc lamp. I wonder if they've ever read a book within 3 inches of an arc lamp. I'll bet they haven't. A key moment, anyway. So you can see that exactly the same kind of lamp appears in a detail of this extraordinary picture by Edouard de Bas-Pensin. The rest of that painting we need not concern us, but you notice immediately the parallels between the two. It's an oil lamp. Here's it's a lamp à modérateur, a moderator lamp. It was fueled with colza oil, and this particular version had a japoniste, probably a cloisonné or majolica base. So this virtually identical moderator lamp on the mantle in the painting at right tells us a lot and gets us closer to this particular family of monstrosities. So, as her adopted city was about to be baptized the electric capital, as it was, as everybody knows, in 1881, Cassatt accorded celebrity status to a rather old-fashioned and demanding yet elegant lamp invented in 1836. It had a spring-activated plunger that, when wound, forced the oil through a narrow tube up to the base of the burner, which enabled the colza oil to be burned efficiently. The moderator lamp, as might be guessed from the intricacy of its internal mechanics, was a sensitive and demanding appliance, rather more like a person than a machine. Quoting an 1872 source, "These lamps are very apt to get out of order, and after being once repaired are still more liable to being so. The greatest care and cleanliness is required in the management of them. Every day the lamp must be trimmed." It goes on and on. Need it be said that these worked best in a house that had servants? And I discovered that moderator lamps were very fashionable among wealthy Americans traveling to Europe or wishing to give the impression of having traveled to Europe in the 1870s and 1880s. They imported and used them as ornamental table lamps, even though they were pretty lousy lamps compared to American kerosene lamps. Without going into more detail, it's pretty clear that a moderator lamp at this moment was preferred and functioned most successfully in a well-to-do household. And this, in turn, echoes an older principle, a sort of keystone principle of the entire history of illumination in human environments, namely, in the bourgeois nest, there was usually a preference for the flame. All of us, as we put out our candles for dinner parties, still continue to support that proposition. Though, as you can see, as this flame-bearing lamp shows up in Cassatt's etched representation, it's certainly flattened out and abstracted compared to what would have been the variegation of a flickering light. Indeed, the moon-egg disc of the etched lamp globe works in sync with the severe monochromatic tonalities of the image to erase the flame and forestall the flicker. Now, look, once you go through this point-by-point, you know, analysis of the painted lamp, the sort of touchstone documentary representation of the lamp, and Cassatt's etch versions, all the way through all these etchings, you can see all the things that she didn't bother with. Maybe you're not interested in the thumb wheel and also all the various things at the throat of the lamp. These little things that were included here. She's also not very interested in the footed base. You can see those are generalized or finessed. But by far the most significant eccentricity of Cassatt's depiction of her lamp is the consistent practice of eliminating the chimney, right? Be plenty hard to operate an oil lamp like that without the chimney on the top. It's sawn off, so to speak, in each of the pictures decisively and definitively, which makes her perspicuous rounding off of the globe exactly at the picture's edge in every instance a conscious calculation. Cassatt's globes are decapitated. They're reduced to 100% luminosity and pure aesthetic form. So the aesthetic move she made here was a gesture against, right, a denotation of that lamp's specific functionality. Indeed, it inscribes, to put it somewhat cumbersomely, the non-affirmative nature of the print's relationship with the material culture of its immediate ostensible surroundings. So I can now, yeah, so here's a wood engraving. It was a journal illustration of this is where that Chom set his caricature that we looked at earlier, and here we now see this whole array, this whole section of the pretty new Avenue de l'Opéra lined with these blinding new lights. So now maybe you can see the basis of this major claim of mine about these things. Her objective referent came from the public sphere, the world of street furniture. Cassatt's moderator lamp functions, dazzling without illuminating, as if it were an electric arc street light rather than an oil parlor lamp. Here they are together. Backing up this point, right, is the very striking resemblance between her lamp globes and the bright white, flawlessly circular white fixtures of the Yablokov lamps lining the Avenue de l'Opéra as of 1878, as represented over and over and over again in stylizations in illustrations. I'm almost done now. Cassatt's, let's look at the quartet while I try to sum up. Okay, so Cassatt's oddly unlit, indeed gloomy interiors overseen by glaring light globes surely deserve to be understood as displaced evocations of the controversial blaze on the boulevards beyond her apartment walls. Her own library space served as a pretext or alibi for an examination of the signature visuality and contrasting tonalities of the most topical urban illumination environment of her day. In this cluster of graphic works, the table oil lamp is a metaphorical and portmanteau kind of equipment. Its distinctive circle of luminosity is an artifact of recognizably upper bourgeois female taste, not to mention a world of lighting convenience unthinkable without servants, which mirrors at the same time the notorious, right, eye-burning lamps of the street. So when Cassatt tackled light via lighting, in French, lumière via éclairage, in her first intensive printmaking campaign, I'd like to propose that luminophilia was splintered by luminophobia. The love of light was splintered by the fear of light. The luminophobia pertains to the contingent upper-class female dislike of glaring lights. Can you say Downton Abbey? While the luminophilia concerns a more foundational and enduring attraction to the pleasures and comforts of the flame-lit private bourgeois interior, Cassatt's light aversion was at the same time an anxiety, both ocular and social, a dislike of the noxious glare, but also the inelegance and vulgarity of the new light that cross-cut the trendiness and modernity of the light cults of the moment. So her light enthusiasm was traditionally bourgeois, but also it can now be seen, I think, a sign of her up-to-dateness and a component of her desire, the aspiration of a voluntarily uprooted American lady to be seen as an assimilated Parisian artist, fully clued in to the codes and signature trends of urban modernity. This can be linked to what I said about those so-called mother and child pictures earlier, but maybe we can all do that hermeneutic gymnastic when we get home. The etching's engagement with modernity and its signature visualities, in other words, was an intimate union with an old-fashioned and elegant apartment interior conjoined with the codes of modernist representation that was also a hostile encounter manifest in her mobilization of a surrogate lamp for a nightmare. Last point. Here's this remarkable portrait of Mary Cassatt by Degas that's in the galleries right now. It's just been cleaned. It's more resplendent than ever. And here's a contemporaneous lithograph by Degas in which Degas displays in so many ways his cognate, maybe even more exaggerated. He had a kind of access that Mary Cassatt never would have had to this the multi-illuminations of the modern urban night. He includes at least five different kinds of lamplight there and then polishes it off with a stream of fireworks. Anyway, I've always thought this, but I think it more even now. So this portrait has begun right during the time when they're in their most, you know, sort of regular, collegial, constant dialogue with each other, working like mad preparing prints. As you learned about upstairs, for the journal that was not to be, but what they were planning, the journal that would be called Day and Night, Le Jour et la Nuit. And it's in these years that he paints her with this dazzling explosion of bright white stripes behind her head. Well, guess what I think that is? I think that it refers, somewhat mischievously but unmistakably, to the glare of contemporary illumination. And I think that if we look at these two pictures side by side, we might be able to posit yet another bond between these two artists. Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, Mary Cassatt and Edgar Degas were both illumination nerds of the highest water. Their preoccupation, the dialogue back and forth between the tonalities of their own work and the changing, volatile atmosphere of illumination in their own city, helps to explain the link between them. And this is the coda, very quickly. I mean, one of the things that I think I can pull out of the hat at the very end in order to shore up my claim that they were working in an atmosphere of nonstop, day in, day out, I guess today we would say 24/7 preoccupation with the changing artificial illumination environment, is demonstrated by this first draft. I know it's by the devil, Felix Brachmon, but he didn't become an anti-American until 1891. Anyway, Brachmon made this first draft that might have been the cover for their journal, Le Jour et la Nuit. And the cover, right, there it is, evokes the two modern night lights par excellence, that old standby of celestial illumination, the moon. And I think this strange rig up here with all of the little lines coming off of it is a tip of the hat in the direction of a stylized contemporary street lamp. I think that even the first draft for the cover of this enterprise that's so fully conjoined Degas and Cassatt speaks to a condition which can only be called, I see I've actually written this down on a piece of paper, lights on the brain. Okay, that's it. That's the end. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast. Mm-hmm.